I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. This week, I watched Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore on HBO Max, and I want to talk about it. And let me just, I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the Harry Potter universe first before I go into actually the, I'm going to talk about the universe and I'm talking about JK before going into the review of the movie itself. And I'm going to just start by saying I have seen a few of the Harry Potter films. I have never read a single book, do not intend to. I have watched part of the first Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, and now I have watched this one. I recognize that my comprehension of the entire Harry Potter universe is lacking understanding. But what I do know is that Fantastic Beasts is a pre... I keep saying Fantastic Beasts. Beasts is a prequel to... Prequels to Harry Potter, and that the things that happen in Fantastic Beasts, that series, set up the world in which Harry Potter's story takes place. I imagine that understanding is worth its weight in gold, because that then allows you to put the movies in appropriate context. But if you really want to go there, it allows you to put the books in proper context. I have not done the research to recognize whether or not Fantastic Beasts was a book itself or a screenplay adaptation, and the machinations of somebody reading the first Harry Potter books and then building a universe as a prequel before that. Like, I don't know. I don't know none of that. And I'm not going to look into it. I think this movie was imaginative enough, because I like sci-fi. Y'all, if you've listened to the show for any length of time, I have shared my love for science fiction. I have shared my deeper love, though, for Afrofuturism. And so anytime I see representation, clear representation of a black character, not a black character a black actor that they're trying to pass off as some other ethnicity, because they do that so much. And I'm not begrudging the actor, because you got to earn a living just like everyone else. But like, there's becomes a certain point where your influence should really dictate how you can use your influence to affect change. You're just not empowered to do so. Or not inclined, because you don't give a crap. But anyway, let me move on. So what I know is there are very few black characters in the Harry Potter universe. If they are, what I've noticed in the formula is that there are only so many brown skin, you can't imagine them to be anything else. Deep brown skin folks, characters in there. And of course they're like background or they're like secondary characters. And then in the Fantastic Beasts series, what I remember is having two, like in the first, what is it? Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. I remember there being two black characters, Zoe Kravitz, and then another woman who I remember as she's a black British actress. I'm pretty sure she is. And I've seen her in a ton of stuff, but is she black British? I cannot remember. But as a black woman that I recognize, she might be black American. I can't remember, because I keep wanting to make her Nia Long, but it's not Nia. Is it? Anyway, I can't remember. But anyway, as a black actress, a visibly black actress, two of them. But Zoe, if you don't know who Zoe is, she looks exotic. She's like the type of, she's light-skinned to me and my family, but, and for a lot of people, but for most people, they can't readily explain her ethnicity. So she just looks exotic. That's that exoticism that that is fetishized in white American mainstream culture and also white British mainstream culture too. I recognize that to be a thing across the globe. Anyway, I mean, colorism is a thing across the globe. It just depends on, it manifests itself differently, but what we know is bleaching happens in India just as much as it happens. It's just as rampant in South Asia as it is on the African continent. And baby, you can tell a person that's bleaching, baby. All you have to do is look at those lips, look at those knuckles. Lips and knuckles. You can't, and even sometimes the elbows, but like, not really. If you do a really good job on the elbows, you Gucci, but like, you cannot hide. There's a, oh, and around the eyes too, because you can't put the chemical around super close to the eyes. So you can always tell around the rims of the eyes, the lips. Sometimes you can tell by the lips. Most times you can. It's just sometimes people are a little bit more thorough than others. And then the knuckles, right? And we all know that trick. But anyway, so because bleaching is a thing everywhere. K-pop beauty, they literally have bleaching agents in all of the beauty creams because it's a fashion statement. What do they say? It's a fashion statement, right? So anyway, colorism exists everywhere. So I'm not exactly, while I'm looking at these films from European or Western, sorry, these are Western films. I'm looking at it from a Western lens. I'm not so naive as to assume that the colorism that exists and the texturism that exists in all of this Harry Potter universe is just isolated to Western culture. It's not. Western cinema. It's not. That said, the film, this is what I know. This is what I think I can piece together. So after the Harry Potter books came out and had been out for years, I remember hearing on podcasts, I remember listening to The Read, and I know that Crystal was a huge fan of probably still is a huge fan of the Harry Potter series. Read them all when they came out. And was not a fan of the movies because the movies diverted from the books, like the third one in. And as that tends to happen, sometimes the books just do not, or the film adaptations just do not dance well, partner well with the series. And even if it does, like I can remember watching Mystic River after having read it 2 years prior and remember thinking, this film, good as it is, had Sean Penn doing his best acting, as well as Kevin Bacon, I think, was in it. But then also, it was the guy that was Tim, the guy that was married partnered with Susan Sarandon, Tim something. Anyway, doing their best acting and all of that. And yet, I can remember this film is not ever gonna hold a candle, not for real, to the book, because the book was so well written. There's just some nuances that your best actors just aren't gonna get all of it. And even if it's the actors doing their due diligence, there's just some things that you're not gonna be able to translate well into cinematography, no matter how much animation budget you have and all of that. And so I recognized her saying, Crystal, as an avid fan of the books, not enjoying the films because there's just certain things that need to play well in the films. But one of the things that I remember sticking out about the difference between the films, or people talking about the difference between the film and the books, is Hermione's portrayal, and that Hermione had frizzy hair. And in the film adaptation, of course, it's a little white girl that had frizzy hair. Now, depending on your cultural background, frizzy can mean a whole lot of things. To a lot of black people that were reading the Harry Potter books, frizzy, coily, fuzzy, or whatever hair is not hair that needs some conditioner. The way that it read to a lot of black and brown people who read it was that Hermione wasn't a lily white little girl. But the way that it was portrayed, Hermione was portrayed in the films, as we know, was a little white girl who they put, who just did not know how to take care of her hair, had a lot of split ends. Because that's what that came across to me. No shade. That's how it came across to me. A little girl whose parents did not know how to take care of her hair. There was absolutely no reason why her hair looked like it had been in a dryer without a dryer sheet. Or that it did not have any fabric softener next to it. Like, frizzy hair, unkempt, unconditioned, looked dry. Like, anytime you see a little girl that looking like that, the parents are not taking care of their hair. And then they go through that weird stage. I'm talking about the little white girls that have textured hair. When anytime you see them and it's uber fuzzy, it's because ain't nobody in their life taking care of their hair for real. Like, you need a little bit of oil, a light, your hair's thirsty. Anytime you see somebody with frizzy hair or some white person with frizzy hair, their hair is thirsty. Those ends need to be clipped. They need a deep conditioner. And also, probably, they're fighting against the curls that naturally occur in their hair, trying to get it to look straight. Mm-hmm, and looking a fright. Anyway, that's what that little girl's hair looked like to me. A mess. I'm pretty sure I saw the first movie with my mama. Because my mama is a sci-fi head, too. I'm sure I've shared that before. But anyway, we watched Harry Potter together. The first movie together. And I just remember thinking, do this child's hair. It's not cute. She just looked like don't nobody care about her hair. And nobody's taught her to have to care for her hair. But a lot of black and brown people who read the books thought that this little girl should have been a little black girl, but of course not. So, right. So they go through this whole main and mostly supporting cast of white characters with a few brown people visibly, like, unmistakably black and unmistakably Asian characters sprinkled in the mix. Right. But it was a majority white cast. And you watched it because that's what Hollywood pulled forth. Well, Western, was it? What? I guess that's part of the Disney universe, right? So let's call it Hollywood. You know, and it's set in like 18 something, like turn of the century London. I guess that's what it's meant to. That's what the setting is meant to give off, basically. And so, you know, it's supposed to, I don't even know what it's supposed to be given, but we're supposed to be totally cool with the lack of representation of black and brown people. Like, ain't too many Asian people, not too many people of color, period, in this world. And we're supposed to be cool with it. We're still supposed to find representation in a few handful of extras that you put in there. Anyway, but again, we're used to Hollywood feeding us this BS that in our fantasy movies, even our fantasies have to be segregated. Even our fantasies have to be predominantly white because, God forbid, it just would not be believable if it was majority brown. It just would not be believable. Anyway, so I understood that, and I actually stopped watching it after a couple, because I'm like, I'm not finna keep watching these little white kids do this. I can watch other things. This is not, and plus I was a teenager when it came out. Like, and I was in my late teens at that when it came out. So I'm like, I'm not, it's okay. Or the movies came out. I was probably a preteen or just a teenager when the books came out, but I wasn't into it, and I left off, and I think mama had moved on too. We had moved on to other, I think it was Lord of the Rings, actually. I can't remember the timing of when they all came out, but we even lost interest in Lord of the Rings for the same doggone reason, that representation. Like, again, your fantasies have to be lily white. You just can't. Even when you pretending, your pretend has to be majority, it has to be lily white. Anyway, even though you and I know that's not true, and even though there's tons of Afrofuturistic art out there, and oh my goodness, that Asian sci-fi is something to behold, honey. There are genres of art that exist that center brown people, black and brown people. That is not a novelty because it centers black and brown people, but it's rich full of imagination. I say this all the time when I film, when I review media that I watch from different movie centers, film industry centers, because you just could never imagine some of the stories that come out of those movie film industry centers would never come out of West. They just would not come out of Western culture because there's so many other that Squid Games would never have come out. I've said that. I said this when I reviewed it. Squid Games would never come out of Western media. Just wouldn't. But you cannot say the same about Harry Potter. You can't. Because to say that so here's why. So Squid Games could not have come out of Western culture because Squid Games, number one, those games, while they're childhood games, they're literally based on culturally relevant childhood games in South Korean. Well, I don't know if it's specific to South Korea, but almost every adult and most kids in South Korea know those games that were playing. It's just they did a Jordan Peele where they like took and made it Jordan Peele and made it about class. Not to say that you cannot make movies about class, because at the end of the day, Squid Games and The Parasite are all about class, just very specific to the regions where they're coming from. Much like. And so while you could always make a film about class, and just like Get Out was a film about racial disparities, especially the commodification of blackness, right? You can make a film about commodification of cultural appropriation, but from anywhere and societal what am I trying to say? You can make a commentary about societal issues from anywhere. That's not a Western or Eastern or any other geographic location concept. It's just the lens with which you use is specific to the culture that you're coming from. And so while not every culture could have produced a Get Out, a Squid Games, a Parasite, what I would say is Harry Potter could have been produced in any form anywhere else because it's not a cultural commentary. There's not a cultural commentary there. And why am I saying that? I'm saying it because the conversation that came out about the books after the fact from J.K. Rowling made it seem like it was deeper than it actually was. She had the control to determine who in the heck, what characters played who, or at the very least, she could have been open about not enjoying the cast that they picked. These were literal kids that had very little to no acting experience. Or even if they did have some acting experience, they weren't like uber advanced. And so you can't say that, oh, all of these kids have this perfect talent. No, that she could have influenced the casting director to go anywhere that she wanted them to go that fit the story, but she didn't. But it felt to me, and maybe I'm missing some things, but it felt to me that after the fact, after the films became super popular, we were on our like fourth or fifth, then she starts talking about how, oh, I intended for Hermione to be black. There, of course, there were plays that started to come out where there was controversy that there was a black woman that I think it was a British theater troupe that was initially doing the plays, and Hermione was cast as a black woman. And there was a lot of uproar, a lot of controversy and around that. And it was around this time where J.K. Rowling started to speak up and say all of this stuff like Hermione, of course Hermione was black, and oh, Dumbledore is gay. And I'm like, girl, like it felt very, I'm going to assign meaning where there wasn't any. Because again, the meaning is built into the fabric of the story of Get Out, of Squid Games, of more so Parasite, really Parasite. Even though Squid Games has some social commentary in there, it's really There's some other things at play there. Let's just talk specifically about Parasite, because we're talking about social commentaries, right? Harry Potter, to me, did not purport itself, and this is me saying this as having never read the books, so maybe there's just some pieces that I'm missing. But Harry Potter never to me thought of itself as providing social commentary in a sci-fi setting. But here comes J.K. Rowling after all of the films are coming out. Most of the films have come out. Now she's assigning meaning where there was none. If Dumbledore was, and this has relevance because I'm not a gay person. I consider myself to be an ally. I could always be doing more, but I'm not a gay person. But there's a thing that I'm going to say in the review of, it feels like pandering. Spoiler alert, this thing feels really like pandering to me. Because again, when J.K. Rowling came out, and everybody understands that J.K. Rowling has said a whole lot of stuff. She's come out as a TERF. But before she came out as a TERF, and I'll explain that in a minute. Before she came out as a TERF, again, there was this point where she was starting to assign meaning where, to me, it was clear that there was none. And I don't even know why she felt like doing that, except that she was trying to protect herself from, I guess, what was coming. Because again, she said Dumbledore was gay. And I'm like, girl, number one, on the one hand, it was like, okay, you said Hermione was black. It was intended to be a little black girl. And Dumbledore is gay. If you thought that was integral to your story, why in the world was it not part of the original series? Or if it couldn't have been part of the original series because Disney was trying to give you so much flack, right? So much pushback. And you were poor at the time and you were just trying to get a come up, right? Why didn't you say that when you, like, I don't know. It feels very convenient. It felt convenient then and it remains convenient now because, again, for somebody that said, oh, black people and people of color were always part of the universe, you still, even with these new films, you still have people of color way back. Like, they're still not main characters. Your main characters are still very much Lily White. And I don't know if I don't know what her stake in Fantastic Beasts is, because I don't know if she wrote Fantastic Beasts or somebody wrote an adaptation based on the film and had nothing to do with her. And it was one of those things where she couldn't do nothing about it because it wasn't your story. I don't know. I don't know that part, but it just feels so. Her statements about Dumbledore being gay and Hermione being black felt forced, felt like, girl, you doing a lot right now. And it just, I don't see it. I don't see it. You didn't make it relevant in the films. I wonder if you made it relevant in the books. And to that, I say, I highly doubt that. But then she started making comments about being a TERF. And I've shared before that I, once upon a time, I myself was a TERF. I never necessarily, I don't know that I ever identified as being a TERF, but I was a TERF. And so let me just tell you what a TERF is right quick, just so that we're all in the same understanding. Hold on. Let me do TERF. And you could Google this, but so, okay, that's not what TERF. TERF. All right, TERF meaning gender. Aha. Oh, I'm spelling it wrong. What a nincompoop. I'm spelling it wrong. Okay. All right, so, and as soon as when, wouldn't you know it, as soon as when I spelled TERF right, correctly, and it's TERF, and it's in all caps, the third entry is about J.K. Rowling and some tweets that she made. But anyway, so let me just tell you what it is. So it's TERF, as I said. And a TERF is an acronym for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist, which in short terms, A lot of people identify with white feminism, which is a whole nother conversation. For the longest time, I never considered myself to be a feminist. I would, if I thought about it at all, I considered myself to be a womanist in the same way that Angela Davis at one point considered herself to be a womanist, because feminism was relegated to white feminism. And through, especially from a Western point of view, an American, Western American point of view, white women have always championed for themselves. White feminists had championed for themselves, but not necessarily championed for everyone. But it came across as if they were championing for everyone. But that just was not so. White women still pushed themselves, catapulted themselves to the forefront. Even in equity movements, like let me just not do all of that. But long story short, one of the reasons why I had the hardest time, and I still do struggle with calling myself a feminist, is because the way I see white feminists move is not a way that I want to identify with. It's not something I want to identify with. It feels very toxic. Like it feels toxic and it feels exclusionary, even though those are both antithetical to what it's supposed to mean. And so TERFism is associated with a whole lot of, with white feminism in a lot of ways, although what I can say with 100% certainty is that I have heard, well, not 100% certainty, but what I can say is I have heard women who identify as feminists of all cultural backgrounds, who, some of whom also have a hard time wrapping themselves around the inclusion of trans women. And so this is what TERF is. TERF is used to describe cisgender women who self-identify as feminists, but who are opposed to including transgender women in spaces they reserve for people who are assigned female at birth. And so that's literally the crux of the argument, right? And for the longest time I sat there, you are a trans person. I recognize you to feel as if, move as if, operate as if, identify as a woman, but in my mind, you will never be a woman. You are a trans woman. That's what I thought when I was standing up in my TERFism, whatever. When I believed that way, that's genuinely what I thought. There is literally no way that you are a part of my group because you were not raised as a woman. You were not socialized, you were not socialized as a woman, you cannot relate. But when I said that, what I was excluding, what I wasn't accounting for, is the fact that a person that identifies as a woman probably has been fighting, most of the time they've been fighting that identity their whole life. And so, no, while they were not socialized as a woman, they were certainly fighting for their own identity internally first. From the very first struggle was with themselves in the very beginning. No matter when they stopped fighting themselves, stopped fighting who they actually were. That's what I was not taking that into account. I've never, as a woman, I've never struggled with my own identity. I'm a cisgendered person. This is what I've never struggled with. I've never struggled with recognizing that I was black. I've never struggled with recognizing that I identified as, well, let me separate my cultural background. I have never struggled with knowing that I was a woman. I have felt like I was a girl my entire life. I've never felt any other way. Now, have I wished that I could just walk around shirtless? Yes. Have I desired to be held to the same standards as males? Absolutely. But I've always felt like I was where I was supposed to be. I've never not felt like a woman. And so I did not, when I was clearly a TERF, I never considered any of that. I never considered any of that, what the fight internally must be like. So again, you were socialized. Some trans people had been socialized as males. Thank God for people whose family and support system allowed them to figure it out, even in the 80s, 70s, 60s, when it wasn't cool to do, and it's not even cool to do, but the more parents have the spine to do what a lot of parents are doing today, which is allowing their child, and not a ton, let's be for real, but more parents today are allowing their children to figure this thing out, because you can't tell them how they feel. You cannot tell a person how they feel. That's the fundamental truth. You cannot tell a person how they feel about themselves or how they perceive themselves. You can't. You can only listen and acknowledge and support. That's what you can do. And so when I was thinking of, when I was standing up in my turfism, I wasn't being rude. It was a simple, it was a fact. And I had run into trans folks that recognized themselves, that did not identify themselves as a woman. How can I say this? They identified as a trans person, neither male nor female. If they were, and I'm getting the terminology wrong, but here's where I'm going. I used to think that way, but in thinking that way, that was absolutely counterintuitive. Being a TERF is absolutely counterintuitive to feminism itself, to being someone who's a champion for, it's counterintuitive, because being a TERF absolutely negates someone else's existence, which is again what a quote unquote anti-racist, anti-queer bullying person is supposed to do. That's antithetical to what you're supposed to be doing, right? You're supposed to be acknowledging someone's existence as it is, not questioning it, not not degrading it or whatever the terminology is. You follow. Anyway, and so it was, you know what stopped me from being a TERF? Rachel Dolezal. And I'm so sorry for even bringing her up, bringing that name up. You didn't go a long while without hearing her name. But when she came up talking about she was transracial, that whole debate cleared my TERFism right on up. I was delivered from the affliction of TERFism. Because, and I will tell you, I had one discussion with a homegirl of mine, and I was like, I'm gonna be honest with you. Because at the point where here, I was already on the cusp. I was already thinking something about my TERFism, me thinking this way, isn't right. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it. I hadn't understood that I was denying their own self-determination. I was denying how they felt about themselves, what they knew to be true, just like what I knew to be true about me. I was denying that in them. And I wasn't all the way curled over just yet. But in my conversation with mine, I think I straight up asked her a question. And I will say this right now. You gotta allow your friends to be vulnerable with you. And you got to be vulnerable with your friends. And you got to pick the right one. You can't have certain conversations with your fair weather friends. You got to have certain conversations with your diehards, right? Because if y'all are for real, then you're going to be able to ask questions that make you vulnerable. But then you learn from them. Because we live in a society where you can't ask a question on social that you can't ask a question, period, because half the time people be like, oh, you didn't know that. That make you feel stupid for asking questions, right? So I asked her a question. I was like, well, what in the heck is the difference? I recognize transracial to not be a thing, but at the time I was questioning whether or not transgender was not a thing. Like, I recognized it to be a thing, but I wasn't giving it its full agency, right? And one of the things she told me is, you deep down, I cannot remember exactly what she told me, but the sentiment was, you knew when you knew when you knew, you've been knew that you were a woman, right? Never changed. Regardless of how people treated you, you knew who you were. You knew who you loved, or not loved, you knew who you were attracted to, and you knew how you identified even before anybody put any labels to it. You grew up and you understood what the labels were. Culturally speaking, you are ethnically Black and culturally Black because of where you grew up. You had no control over that. You had not, it wasn't a realization, it was. And I guess I'm not explaining this very well, but transracialism, you can't pick and choose your gender. I mean, I get you can pick and choose your gender, but if you are being for realsies, that is who you are. It's how you feel. It's who you are. For realsies, like, it's internal. Culture is not internal. Culture is, and I'm doing a bad job of explaining this. Smarter people have explained this better than me. But that whole debate about, I was insulted and recognized that Rachel Dolezal was an admirer of Black culture. And at the fullness of time, I can say this and not have vitriol or anger on my lips when I talk about her. But I look at her, and I've said this before, and I know people still don't have sympathy for her, but I have ultimate sympathy for her because she was so uncomfortable in her own skin. She could not find the value in being an ally. She had to be a part of the culture in order to feel good about herself, which is not the same way as a person who is trans. A person who is trans is who they are, and the fight is to be able to identify who they truly are, not the other way around, where you've been socialized and you've identified as being a part of this culture your whole life, and then you are exposed to another culture and decide. That's where she got me, because I have never met a person that was queer. And these days, as I'm meeting more trans folks, I've never met a trans person that didn't, from a very age, without any undue influence, recognize who they actually were. It was just the quest to hide that was strong and severe in some cases. But trans, racial is not a thing. Absolutely is not a thing. It's not even comparable. Because in order for you to understand the crux of being transracial is you no longer like the culture that you are a part of, and you want to shed it like your country, your citizenship, and belong to another one, right? But you can't do that with cultures. You can do that with countries. You can't do that with cultures. You are an admirer, and you will forever be an admirer. And there, again, gross oversimplification, not even eloquent, but that's the crux of the difference. And it was, like I said, it was Rachel Dolezal that changed my mind. And so, or that helped me to not be the whack turf that I was, even though I didn't even recognize myself to be that. But that whole thing stopped me from being that way. And then I see the J.K. Rowling tweets, and then I see the Chimamanda, what's Chimamanda's last name? Anyway, she's a famous Black British feminist who's also a writer. And she came out as a TERF in support of J.K. Rowling. And I'm like, again, how are you going to call yourself a feminist who wants equality for all, but then you are absolutely denying? Absolutely denying. I'm probably offending somebody. And I really, listen, if you're offended by what I'm saying right now, like, as in support, if you are not in support, if you are in support of TERFism, TERF thinking, we don't vibe anyway. So anyhow, but like, so she said that, and I'm just like, oh, so you just all over the place, ain't you? You just, anyway, so she's effectively like, I'm getting back to J.K. Rowling's. So blah, blah, blah. She had TERF comments. You're welcome to on Twitter. You're welcome to pull those up. I don't think she ever deleted them. Or if she did delete them, somebody screen grabbed them. So you can, again, Google TERF, T-E-R-F, and you will find, like, the third entry you will find. A very high entry will be J.K. Rowling's in her own comments. Anyway, I find it frustrating. When first introduced to the series, there was no mention of sexuality. There was a mention of sexuality. There was automatically the hetero, this young boy, a romantic relationship, a supposedly cutesy romantic relationship between a young boy and a young girl was pushed immediately, right? And several, and then adults, romantic relationships between opposite gender identifying people or characters were pushed immediately, right? In this fantasy, but at no point was race,
appropriately or even adequately or even just acknowledged in the show. And nor was queerness even acknowledged for reals in the show, but or in the series. But then she gonna say it as a writer. And again, I could see if it was something like Color Purple, where the movie did not go as far as the book went in terms of the relationship between Suge and Seeley. But you could tell that there was more there in the film that was omitted. And that you could probably, like any fool could have told you, yeah, there's probably something more to this in the story, but they was too chicken to try to do much in the film, right? My mama was the one that actually told me there was more to Seeley and Suge Avery's love story than was in the film, right? But everybody knew that because she had read the book. Anyhow, but yeah, there is no more there. She was just saying some old stuff, I guess, to be relevant. And then she says this turf stuff. So I'm wondering if what came before the other. She knew she had this trash philosophy, and so she wanted to hurry up and try to get ahead of it. And so anyway, I'm saying all of this to say, just as a reminder that everyone is human and everyone is flawed, and even people who we admire, whose work we admire, are trash in some, and can be trash in some instances. And don't be fooled. Don't be fooled, but also judge the work fairly. But let's be for real. The Harry Potter series was very entertaining. It was entertaining. Yep. A lot of people have made a lot of money off of that, but don't give me no, it had some hidden social commentary meaning in it. It did not. And so anyway, when we get to Fantastic Beasts, and we certainly get to The Secrets of Dumbledore, this film hit you early, really trying to drive the point home. Hey, we're inclusive. Hey, we're just trying to tell a story. And some stories are queer stories. And I'm like, I hear you. And I would have accepted that had that been a part of the storyline the entire time, not just built off of what J.K. Rowling said, and then you're going to tease it out a little bit more. And again, I recognize I might not be fair when I'm saying all of this, but it never leapt out to me before. It never leapt out to me in the original movie. So that they're saying all of this now, it feels like pandering. It feels like hardcore pandering. Nevertheless, the story is still interesting to me because at the end of the day, I love sci-fi. And you had me when you put a brown-skinned woman in there because she's not exotic looking. She's black. She's not exotic. She's black. You put Asian people in there. They're not exotic. They're Asian. And so you had me because, again, I'm a sucker for fantasy. I'm a sucker for sci-fi. So in this next segment, I'm going to talk all about this 2.5-hour movie. Yeah, I'm on the spoiler alert. So if you haven't watched it yet, maybe hold off. Or if you do not care, come on through. Stick around. All right. Okay, so before I get into this, let me just say two things. What I really wanted to say about my apprehension towards fully identifying as a feminist is that it doesn't feel like feminism supports black women 100%. It doesn't feel that way, not to me. And so I haven't experienced that in my life. Now, mind you, I spent a lot of my life being anti-woman. What is it? What's the correlation between, you know, what's the equivalent of being anti-black, but you're a woman, like anti-woman? Oh, I forget the name of it, but like I was misogynist. Can I use that word? Anyway, I was very much not in support of women as I am today. Supportive of it. Anyway, I don't even know the right terminology, but you understand what I mean. I spent a lot of time kind of being a self-hating woman in a way, basically policing women. I was one of the crew that would help police women's bodies because my body had been policed so much, right? I was a part of that crew. Then I slid into the without even knowing it, I slid into the turf crew. And now I feel like I'm firmly out of all of that, and I'm just trying to feel my way out to be the very best human being that I could be in support of women, in support of everyone, but protecting women, specifically Black women, because doggone it, anytime you make foundations and have whole documentaries specifically shedding light, to shed light on Black women and women with an X, come on, that shouldn't be, right? We shouldn't have to do that, but here we are. So anyway, that's why, that's like the root of it. It feels like it's all women until it needs to be Black women, and then only Black women. It feels like only the loudest crowd is Black women, and there's no rah, rah, rah in the feminist community as at large across cultures in support of Black women. Now, anyway, that's kind of how I feel, which is why I have trepidation about even going whole hog and just saying, yep, I'm a feminist, because it just doesn't feel like it fits. It doesn't feel like it fits me, because it feels like a moniker that doesn't fit me, because it doesn't feel like it truly supports me. I guess that's the best way I can describe it. But again, that could just be me. You know what I mean? But that's kind of where I am. And the other thing that I want to say, because it's Pride Month, I'm looking at this in the same critical way that I look at representation for Black folks and Black women specifically. It's not good enough for me that you have a Black woman in the show. It's not. It's not even good enough for me that you have a dark-skinned Black woman in the show, in your thing. It's not. Because that feels like a performance. It feels like you're putting on. And let's be clear. I think I said in the intro, because you know I'm recording this. I recorded the intro days ago. So the brown-skinned Black woman in this film feels like, while I appreciate the actress, feels very much like, yeah, let's make sure she's brown, like brown, brown. Let's put her in there. And oh, we want some Asians? Bam, let's put them in there. And oh, Dumbledore is gay, right? So let's play that one up. I got a problem with that. Because the thing about it is, yes, representation matters, but also the approach to representation matters too. And maybe it's just me, maybe I'm doing too much, but their treatment of Dumbledore as being gay, It's like somebody was trying really hard to let you know that this person is gay while also trying not to make it a big deal. Just trying to make it like normal. And I'm like, I can't quite put my finger on it, but I feel like, again, because it feels just like Hermione being a Black girl, again, J.K. Rowling's coming out and saying that Hermione was a Black girl. Like, coming out and saying Dumbledore was gay. Shouldn't that be apparent in your writing? It should be apparent in your writing. We shouldn't have to manufacture some storylines around that. It should just be, right? And so when you come into a thing like Fantastic Beasts and you're creating the backstory to, you're filling in the holes in the history to what got us to Hogwarts and Harry, seems to me that, and I'm about to spoil this, but you know, there's your warning, but it seems to me that you'd probably put a little bit of more energy into it. The best storyline you could come up with is that he is in love with an evil person, someone who once was good but now is evil. Feels contrived. Also, it just feels contrived to me, but I'm gonna let, on the one hand, because they're good actors, well, hold on, let me get to it in a minute, because I'm running ahead, but anyway, representation matters, But your approach to that representation to me matters just as much, if not more. It's not good enough. It's not good enough that you have a gay character. It's not good enough that you have a Black girl in there. It's not good enough that you have an Asian character. It's not good enough that you have more women represented. That's not good enough to me. There needs to be some character to them. There needs to be some backstory. They got to be more than one dimensional. And for as mysterious and as much mystique is surrounding Dumbledore, literally this film is called The Secrets of Dumbledore. Girl, what secret? Secrets. It says secrets plural. One of those secrets wasn't even Dumbledore's, or at least the Dumbledore that we're following. One of those secrets wasn't even his. Dumbledore as played by Jude Law had one secret, and we'll get to the one secret. But anyway, unless I heard another one, but I fell asleep and missed it. Anyhow, but let me get to the, so you already kind of, it's like I like this film, but like I'm fighting it at the same time. So, but let me get to it. So this thing was released April 15th of this year, and its runtime is 2 hours and 23 minutes. I fell asleep twice. I'm pretty sure I couldn't have fallen asleep more than 5 minutes each time, but that tells you that there are at least two lulls in this nearly 2.5 hour film. I don't know why it was 2.5 hours. Is actually my real question, because feels like you could have shaved yourself 45 minutes and done just as well. But anyway, so that's the runtime. Director was David Yates. I don't know what any of that means. The distributed by Warner Brothers. Gilbert. Girl, is it Gilbert? What is it? Gilbert Grindelwald. Gilbert Grindelwald is played by Mads Mikkelsen, who played Hannibal Lecter in Hannibal. Eddie Redmayne plays Newt Scamander, which you know from the other Fantastic Beasts. Jude Law plays Albus Dumbledore. I'm focusing on, well, actually, I'm really just going to, all right, well, let me tell you some other people. There's some other people in here. You can look. I will tell you the Black girls, Jessica Williams, Claudia Kim, who actually don't think she's, actually don't think she has a, I don't remember her character name, but Jessica Williams plays Eulalie Hicks. This is the brown girl who is on the good girl, on the good guys team with Scamander. What is his name? Yeah, Newt Scamander. And Aberforth Dumbledore is played by Richard Coyle. Aberforth Dumbledore is Albus Dumbledore's brother. There's another Black person in here who's visibly brown, doesn't look exotic, just looks brown, or looks like a Black person, which is, well, actually, but he's supposed to be Algerian, so there's a little exoticism there. And William Nadilam plays Yusuf Kama. Yeah, so he's supposed to be, North African. And that's all who I care to talk about. There's some other people in here that you recognize from the other Fantastic Beasts. Dan Folger plays Jacob Kowalski. Allison Sudo plays Queenie Goldstein, who I thought was Queenie Goldstein was played by another actress, but maybe she just looks like another actress. Anyway, but I think this is what I'll do. I think I'll just spend most of my time talking about Gilbert Grindelwald and Professor Dumbledore. You know what they did? They don't even have him listed here. Oh, that's kind of trifling. Okay, so the actor who's in a lot of trouble these days for beating up people and getting rowdy in karaoke bars. What's that person's name? Hold on.
what the heck is that person's name? They're not listed here. Hold on, I'll go here. Ezra Miller. Ezra Miller, dears. So Ezra Miller is in a lot of trouble, and I'm pretty sure gonna have a hard time finding work in Hollywood. Who knows? But anyway, he plays, who do he play? Oh, Credence Barenboim, who is really Aurelius Dumbledore. And we'll get to, so remember, Aurelius Dumbledore, Aurelius Dumbledore, Aberforth Dumbledore, and then Albus. So, look at that, all A's. Aurelius, Aberforth, and Albus. Anyhow, the three of them are really integral to the story. To be honest with you, Newt Scamander is kind of like an accessory character completely. And rightly so, because the story is called Fantastic Beasts, the Secrets of Dumbledore. So again, I confess that I do not know how Newt Scamander fits into the grand scheme of things, but I know how Albus Dumbledore fits into it. So here we go. Let me do this. Did I say his name was Aloysius? Let me just do this. What was Ezra Miller's character name? I'm about to say Aloysius. Aurelius. Like Marcus Aurelius. Aurelius Aberforth and Albus. Okay, so let me just get that in my spirit. All right, so let me get to the plot of this bad boy. Well, no, before I get to the plot, so I've told you who some of the stars are that we're going to focus on. Now let me tell you the premise of this film, or the plot of this film. So Professor Albus Dumbledore knows the powerful dark wizard Gellert Grindelwald is moving to seize power, Professor Albus Dumbledore knows the powerful dark wizard Grindelwald is moving to seize control of the wizarding world. Unable to stop him alone, he entrusts magi zoologist Newt Scamander to lead an intrepid team of wizards and witches. They soon encounter an array of old and new beasts as they clash with Grindelwald's growing legion of followers. Okay. So it's, as I said, it was released in theaters April 15th. It's on HBO Max, where I watched it. At present, do I have any of the box office numbers? I wonder if I can find any of the box office numbers, because that would be I think that's important. And I can't seem to find any, so it doesn't matter. Anyway, here's what you need to know. It's got a 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb, 47% rotten on Rotten Tomatoes, 47% on Metacritic, and 77% of Google users like this film, of which I am one, even though I've been fighting it this whole time. Now, let me tell you what I can. So, all right, here it is. So, the critic score as of this recording is 47%, as I mentioned, on the tomato meter, and that is with 219 reviews. It's 83%, however, fresh as an audience score with over 2,500 verified ratings. And so the critics' consensus of this thing, and it's interesting that there's nearly a 40% difference between the score ratings, and I think largely because, you know, critics are kind of looking at this thing like, if this is supposed to be a prequel, one of the prequels that really sets up a lot of work for the universe of Harry Potter, then how did this movie measure up to the work that needed to be done, to the task? Whereas audience members really were looking at it
from a, how does this film fit into the universe? The Harry Potter movies are done, right? They've capped it off. They're grown. They're finished. They have kids of their own and all of that stuff. So let's go back and how does this thing fit into the cinematic universe? And so that feels like an honest perception of it, which is why it might be, that might be the rationale for why the scoring is so varied. And so the critics' consensus is Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore avoids some of the pitfalls that plagued its predecessors, but lacks much of the magic that drew audiences into the Wizarding World many movies ago. Which, so again, my assessment still kind of falls true. Again, Harry Potter was full of wizardry and magic. And if you're thinking about the Fantastic Beasts world, there, what are the three movies? This is the third movie in that particular franchise that's in the universe. Lots of magic everywhere, lots of spells cast, lots of weird beasts, lots of intrigue and crime and all of that stuff. And so when you think about it from the critics' perspective, yeah, I would understand why that would be the consensus. Because if you're trying to stack up to your predecessors, you need to kind of come with it. And again, when you put Secrets of Dumbledore in your title, you're expecting secrets, plural, from Dumbledore. But what we actually get, and again, when we're saying Secrets of Dumbledore, the implication is it's Professor Dumbledore, Albus Dumbledore, not other people, but like his secrets. And so you're expecting something juicy. I was expecting something juicy, not having an allegiance to the cinematic universe at all. I was expecting something juicy. And I was pulled in because Jude Law is a bomb actor. He's like a award-winning actor. And then also Mads Mikkelsen is another award-winning actor. This is a completely different turn for him. And I actually like it when he plays a bad guy because he plays a really good bad guy. Anyway, so yeah, I'm... Even though I said I like this film, I actually agree. This thing does not deliver on the action and the magic, which is probably why I fell asleep twice. Anyway, but the audience score says it's a little too long. Well, it's a little long and the effects might be better than the story. But for fans of the franchise, this is a fairly fantastic sequel. I'm not reading more. I'm not reading the reviews. I'm not reading the reviews of the critics or the audience. Again, if you are just itching for fantasy and you're already bought into the cinematic universe, perhaps this is not a bad thing for you. Perhaps this is something that's like, all right, it's not going to fill me up, but it's a good appetizer. It's a good little something or other to keep me engaged in this story, right? So, okay. All right, so we'll live there. We'll leave that there. Okay, so you could probably guess that, you could hear that the sound quality is different. That's because I am yet again recording on a different day, and I'm actually coming from the doctor's, and this is the only time I can finish this. And of course, when I was just getting into recording, getting into the critical response to the film, of course, my daddy called, and then I got sidetracked. So here I am. So please excuse the sound, but I'm going to keep on. I'm going to finish because this recording is long enough at this point. Girl, go. Of course, I'm driving, and it's the morning, so people act like they don't know what they're doing. Anyhow, all right. So Aurelius, Alfred, and Albus, Professor Dumbledore. Okay, so the three of them, and old dude, Eddie Redmayne's character, old dude, he's in there, but let's be for real. This whole show is a vehicle for, I've already said, it's a vehicle for Dumbledore, so here it is. So the very opening scene that we get, it's with, oh shoot, now I need to remember the characters. Okay, hold on, I'm out of light. Eddie Redmayne, okay, Jude Law, come on, before I forget, come on, Grindelwald, okay, Grindelwald. Okay, so a couple of things.
So opening scene, we are introduced to Grindelwald, and Albus, Professor Dumbledore, when they are younger. Whole Fantastic Beasts includes Dumbledore as a younger man, right? And so in this opening scene, the two of them, well, no, Albus, Professor Dumbledore, is in a restaurant and he looks like he's waiting on someone. And it's a nice restaurant, nothing out of the ordinary, just looks like a fancy place to go eat dinner. And then at once in comes, like, there's a whole lot of face acting happening here, P.S., with Professor Dumbledore, with Jude Law playing Professor Dumbledore. Anyhow, a lot of face acting. It feels sentimental. It feels extremely sentimental. Like he might be meeting somebody that he is, like, interested in. Like, it's a romantic meeting. It's not like a, oh, let's go grab dinner. Like, this is a romantic. You know what? This diner, I don't know why, or not diner, but this restaurant, for some reason, this restaurant reminds me of the restaurant in Batman with, Michael Keaton, what's her name? Not Lois Lane, but, oh, I can't remember. Vicki Vale. When Vicki Vale was supposed to be meeting Bruce Wayne at that restaurant in that Batman, and instead she ends up meeting the Joker. And remember the Party Man, Princess Party Man was playing, and the Joker, Jack Nicholson's the Joker was doing the weird, creepy stuff that only his Joker could do. Anyway, I was just flashy. That's a good Joker. He was a good Joker. Anyway, that restaurant scene reminds me of this restaurant scene for some reason. I cannot explain to you why. It's just, it just reminds me of that. Anyway, so Dumbledore is waiting for someone. Turns out the someone that enters is Grindelwald. He's waiting for Grindelwald. And at first you're like, okay. And this is now, mind you, this is me not really knowing too much about the series. Oh, P.S. I did, in looking up the characters and trying to remember Ezra Miller's character, I did see that J.K. Rowling wrote the screenplay for this Fantastic Beast. I imagine she's written the screenplay for all of them. So she's very much in tune. And again, I say this is ham-fisted. The representation feels ham-fisted. It doesn't feel like it's supposed to be a part of the story. It feels like she added that because she wanted to seem cool. But like, anyway, again, representation appropriate, a representation, meaningful represent, well, representation in a meaningful way matters to me. Anyway, but this opening scene, you got Dumbledore meeting Grindelwald, and Grindelwald is dressed very handsomely. Dumbledore looks handsome. Jude Law is a handsome person. Mads Mikkelsen is a handsome person too. So you got two handsome people sitting across from each other, and very quickly you recognize that this rendezvous is a romantic one. They were involved and begin to talk about how they were in love at one point in a nonchalant way. So again, like, on the one hand, I appreciate the representation because it's not done. It's not over. There are aspects of it that I appreciate because this conversation is a conversation between two lovers. It's a conversation between two lovers whose love has gone sour for some reason. And me, as a casual watcher of Fantastic Beasts, I'm gonna just keep saying beats. You know what I'm talking about. It's Fantastic Beasts, but I just like saying beats, apparently. Anyway, so it's a rendezvous between two lovers whose love has gone sour for some reason. And at the end, and you know it's gone sour for some reason because at the end of the rendezvous, there's the scene begins to brighten, but in an ominous way, like, what the heck is happening sort of way. And then I can't exactly remember what happens, but basically it's like the gauntlet is laid down. I can't hurt you. You can't hurt me. But we're not on the same side no more. You're evil. And Dumbledore is basically calling Grindelwald evil because he is. And Grindelwald is telling Dumbledore that you lost your touch. You used to be down. And what happened? So anyway, boom, flash forward. We're introduced to, there's a scene where Scamander, Newt Scamander, is being chased by some of, trying to protect a magical being, a magical animal, and he is unsuccessful in saving the mom, but the mom was pregnant with twins, and while Grindelwald's hench people, that includes Aurelius, takes one of the babies up from the magical being or magical creature, Scamander saves another one, and so sets up the whole plot here. Grindelwald, and I'm just going to cut right into it, because again, this is long going. And again, if you have not watched this thing, I'm so sorry to spoil this thing for you. I'm telling you, I'm spoiling it now, so you can go watch it and then come back if you care. If you don't care, keep on listening. Anyway, so the whole plot of this thing is that Grindelwald is trying to seize power in the magical world so that he can wield it over the non-magical world. And ultimately, he wants to subjugate, I think that's the whole, that's a running theme in Fantastic Beasts. He wants to subjugate, people want to subjugate the non-magical people. And so he wants to do this. He thinks that non-magical people suck and that they don't have a place in the world except to serve magical people. And so boop, bop, bip, that's his master plan. And he does it through subterfuge. He does it through political, moves. And all of that, and again, because he's running for office and he positions himself to be someone who, of the people, who you can depend on, a politician that you can depend on. And so in the midst of all of that, Scamander and everybody else, including Dumbledore, are trying to do what's necessary to stop them, to stop Grindelwald and his henchmen from seizing power. And a whole lot of horse trading happens, and some weird stuff happens in the middle. I guess I'm not going to tell everything. But ultimately, we come to a place where, while that main story of Grindelwald is happening, there's a sub story about why. Baby, are you trying to come over? Anyway, don't you hate it when people who are not in like Big Mac trucks are turning, but they're like, they swing wide in order to turn? I don't understand that. You're not in a Big Mac truck. You're in a sedan. It's a Mitsubishi, baby. You all right? Anyway, that's what happens when you record while you're driving. Anyhow, I promise you, I don't have road rage. I just talk a lot. Anyway, but the secondary story is the rationale for Aurelius. I'm calling him Aurelius because that's his given name. Aurelius Dumbledore, Ezra Miller's character. Why Aurelius is with Grindelwald. Grindelwald is using Aurelius's anger towards Professor Dumbledore, Albus Dumbledore, because Aurelius believes that Albus Dumbledore is his daddy. That's the secret. The supposedly the secret is that Albus is Aurelius's dad. I keep wanting to call him Aloysius. Aurelius's dad. Albus is Aurelius's dad. But in actuality, and he was abandoned, because remember, Aurelius was introduced by another name, and he was living with a poor family, and he was corrupted. His innocence was corrupted because he was magical. In turn, Aurelius is very magical. Anyway, so he's been living in the shadow of his father, who has not claimed him. According to him, he's grown up to believe, he's been led to believe that Albus is his father. And so his hatred for Albus and abandonment, being abandoned by Albus, is the reason why he's with Grindelwald. But the reality of it is, midway, probably like an hour and 20 into the film, we learn that Aurelius is a Dumbledore, but he's not Albus's Dumbledore. Early on in the film, he's not Albus's son. Early on in the film, we're introduced to Alfred, who Albus lives with his brother Alfred. They Alfred runs a pub, something like that. And anyway, we learned that Aurelius's father is actually Alfred. I don't know at this moment, I don't know if Alfred is magical or not, but we know that Aurelius has a lot of power, and his power is not quite equal to Alfred's, but it's Albus's, but it's a lot, like Dumbledore, but he's got a lot of power. He just needs to be refined, and it needs to be channeled away from that anger that he has into love and respect. Anyway, it just needs to be channeled better. So anyway, we find that out, and I keep wanting to say Aloysius. so we find all of this out as viewers, and that's supposed to be the big fat secret. But it's also not supposed to be the secret that, I guess there's supposed to be two secrets. Number one, that Dumbledore was in love with Grindelwald, and they cannot, as much as either one, Grindelwald or Dumbledore, or Albus Dumbledore, would like to take, as much as they would like to take each other out, they can't, because they made a Horcrux. I don't even know if it's called, I don't know if you call this a Horcrux. See, this is where my limited knowledge comes in. I don't know that it's a Horcrux, but it's like this thing, this charm that has both of their blood in it, and it's magical. And they set it up so that should one of them lose heart, because they were supposed to take over the world as lovers, and it should one of them lose heart and punk out on one, that one, the other would not be able to harm them, as long, I guess, as that bond was still there. And in spite of them both being frustrated with each other, that bond is still unbreakable. And so any magic that they tried to do against the other ends up hurting them, and so it's just not worth it. So blots the blue. I don't even know why I brought that up. I guess it's integral to the plot. It's integral to the plot. The reason why one of the most powerful wizards in the whole magical world my husband just sent me a cute text. One of the reasons why one of the most powerful wizards in the whole wide world, or the reason one of the most powerful wizards in the whole wide magical world cannot kill another equally magical, powerful wizard, is because they're bound by love, and the love will not allow them to hurt each other. So anyway, which feels poetic. I'll give her that. It feels poetic and kind of beautiful at the same time. And again, this is well acted by the two of them. So that little piece, but for that little piece, there's not really anything interesting about their relationship that was, and then their enemyship status that they are. Like, there's really not a heck of a lot interesting in it. It's 2 hours and 23 minutes of Scamander running around being weird, and the people around him running around trying to be weird too, or at least being less weird, trying to contain his weirdness. Meanwhile, Dumbledore is trying to figure out a way to defeat Grindelwald. So bloop, blah, bloop. There comes a point in the film, and it's like the end of the film, to be honest with you. It's like in the 2 hours, the last, at the 2 hour mark, feels like. Alfred accepts the fact that he's Aurelius's father. Aurelius is aware now that Alfred is his dad, and that's how he's a Dumbledore, and the circumstances under which he was not with his family is not what it seems. The Dumbledore family is not what it seems. And so his heart begins to soften. His cold heart begins to soften, while he's also still technically in league with Grindelwald and all his henchmen. So anyway, but he switches allegiances, and you know what happens in the end. In the end, Dumbledore and the crew defeat Grindelwald, but I guess one of the very interesting things that happened during the defeat is that Albus Dumbledore, Professor Dumbledore, wholeheartedly goes after Grindelwald, but this time it actually works. Why? Because that love truly is gone. is truly gone for him, and Grindelwald loses his love for Dumbledore too. It's like one of those classic instances where love turns to hatred, and that to me, that's why it feels like it was even possible for them to attack each other, is because that love had soured, not to just bitterness, but it had soured to ultimate hatred, and this hatred is going to be the thing that this hatred is going to be your undoing, not mine, but your undoing. And it's for different reasons, right? So Albus stands in Grindelwald's way of total supremacy. Again, his goal is to subjugate the Muggle world, which is the non-magical people. Everybody in the non-magical that don't have powers, or non-wizards and witches, whatever. And then Dumbledore is like, you cannot do this. You cannot do this. We've been living harmoniously up until this point. Let's not do this now. You own some other stuff. Like that your trips were, and here's the other thing. I think I'm starting to get that maybe at one point Albus was all for subjugating the Muggle world too, when he was with Grindelwald, but like something has happened. And again, it probably would benefit me if I had watched the other Fantastic Beast with some purpose, but I'm not gonna do that anyway. But nevertheless, you get the sense that Dumbledore at one point was truly on some let's subjugate the Muggles, but he's not on that now, for a myriad reasons. So anyway, so we come to the end, and the love that once was is no more, and now it is pure hatred, or at the very least, on Dumbledore's side, it's not so much. It doesn't feel so much as hatred as it feels like justice and righteousness. Whereas on, and that's pretty dangerous too. But on Grindelwald's side, it feels just like pure hatred and oh, you are trash and you are in my way, and also probably a little bit of righteousness too. Because if you think you got the right, if you think you know everything, if you think you got it right, then, you know, I'm justified. It's easy to feel justified and what you're doing. And so there's an epic fight between them. And obviously Dumbledore becomes victorious because, again, that's not a secret. You know, Dumbledore is a very wonderful, celebrated professor in the Harry Potter series. So, of course, you know he's victorious. You know these things happen. But Grindelwald's departure sets up the rest of the world. And it actually sets... So I was reading something the other day, and it said that it sets up Fantastic Beasts 4. Which, girl, okay. Like, literally, the only reason why I watched this one is because of Mads Mikkelsen and Jude Law. Like, that is the reason. Because I thought there was really going to be some secrets, but it turned out the only secret was that... Yeah, that's what I meant to tell you. The two secrets, one of them isn't even Albus's secret. The one secret, he was holding a secret, if you can... Hold on, I lost the earbud. Okay, so one of the secrets that he was holding wasn't his secret, but it was nevertheless a secret, which was that Aurelius was his brother Alfred's son. But his true secret, which wasn't much of a secret, was that he used to be in love with someone who's now a villain who's trying to destroy the world as they know it. Doesn't seem very salacious to me. Doesn't seem very, oh my goodness, you literally spilled the beans in the very beginning. His one secret, the one secret that is actually, that Albus is owns, you tell it in the first 5 minutes of a 2-hour and 23-minute movie. So like, what is there left? So you want me to be engaged in the rest of the 2 hours of this film? You want me to be engaged in the quest to defeat him? You know what's going to happen. You've watched Harry Potter. So why in the world am I invested? And so to the critic's point, where's the magic? Where's the other stuff? There are a few cool scenes. One scene where Aurelius and Albus meet head to head in the street because Aurelius is trying to take Albus Dumbledore out. He's trying to take him out because, again, he's Grindelwald's henchman, but also this is personal for him because you my deadbeat daddy and you abandoned me and I'm trying to get you. You so fancy. Everybody love you, but I'm trying to take you out. So there's a moment where they literally meet up, and it's actually pretty epic. But those things are few and far between. The rest of it, so that I remember, of course, wands came out and all of that stuff, but like the big epic scenes, there were like maybe four big epic scenes, most of which, so like, so the scene where, and epic is a relative term, it depends on how what you consider epic, but what I consider epic was when Aurelius was the leading henchman for Grindelwald and he was trying to get the magical beast for my headphone fell again. I don't know what's going on, but hopefully it stays this time. But when Aurelius was the lead henchman in the core trying to, that killed the magical beast and then stole the baby or one of the babies. So that was kind of cool and magical. There was magic there. Then there was a magical scene where, I mean, there was a little bit of magic here and there. And then the scene between Dumbledore, Albus Dumbledore and Aurelius, that was very cool. I won't describe it. If you watch it, you know what I'm talking about. But if you haven't watched it, I do need you to watch it because there's a very cool scene, like a smack dab in the middle of this thing, between Albus Dumbledore, Professor Dumbledore, and Aurelius. And then at the end, where the plot is coming to an end, it's about to be resolved, with Grindelwald being defeated, right? But the getting there, the last, I would say, the last 20 minutes getting to the resolution, which we all know Grindelwald is going to be defeated, is kind of cool because there's lots of magic that's happening. And then there's a wedding in it, and it doesn't really matter to me. I imagine it matters a lot to folks who are into the franchise, so I apologize for being so flippant about it, but it doesn't really matter too much to me. Anyway, so bloop, blah, blue. Yeah, that's the film in a nutshell. It was a very long film to me. It's a 2-hour and 23-minute film that could have been 1 hour and 45 minutes at best, because there were just some low, laggy moments. And I'm going to be honest with you, one of the times I remember falling asleep was right before the epic climax, which would lead to the resolution of the plot. No shade. Because it was just on and on and on and blue to the blue, blue, blue. You know what I mean? But like, again, I think maybe that's just because this is not necessarily my cup of tea, although it's fantasy, although there are some really cool elements into it. The representation wasn't there for me. I've about had it with this fascination that wizardry is Western. Because that's what the whole franchise is about, right? But J.K. Rowling is a part of the Western world, so I understand why she would have written it that way. But like, it's not really doing the trick for me anymore. You know what I mean? So there were just aspects of this film that did not interest me. But and as a result, I kind of got bored or I fell asleep. But there was still plenty to enjoy. There was still plenty to enjoy in this. I will say the last 10 minutes of this film, well, the last 30 minutes of the film, the resolution of the plot happens, but then in the very, of that 30 minutes, in there's a 20-minute interval where the resolution of the plot happens, and then in the last 10 minutes, there's a wedding, which, and Scamander is, I don't even understand what the ending was supposed to foreshadow. Like the very ending, I'm not 100% sure what the heck that was supposed to foreshadow, except that there's going to be another Fantastic Beast, because I'm not 100% sure where the tie-in between, how do we get from Albus Dumbledore as like a 40-something salt and pepper eligible bachelor to Dumbledore, the old wise, celebrated, kooky wizard? Like, what's the middle there? So if there is going to be a Fantastic Beasts 4, you should spend them a lot more time helping to understand how Dumbledore got to where he is. Because right now, I don't give a crap about Newt Scamander. He's weird and I don't care. Like, everybody in this universe is a little bit weird. Like, why should I care about Newt Scamander? I don't. He's a zoologist, a magic zoologist, as they call him. Okay, great. I don't know. Again, maybe this is not also not for me. Maybe I'm not the target audience. Because at the end of the day, I'd rather just get me to Harry Potter. Get me to the world of Harry Potter. And how Dumbledore ended up in Hogwarts. And being super influential. And get me to Snape and them. Well, yeah, get me there. And I think I missed something in Fantastic Beasts 2 that might have been helpful, because I know Johnny Depp was supposed to be like a predecessor or like an ancestor to Malfoy, I think. I can't remember. I don't know all of that. But somehow or another, Grindelwald is supposed to be something like a predecessor. Because I think Johnny Depp was supposed to be Grindelwald, but he was replaced by Mads Mikkelsen. Right. So Grindelwald is supposed to be, if I remember it correctly, he's supposed to be an ancestor of Malfoy, who's supposed to be a bad guy. The blonde kid that's a bad guy, and they're super rich and all of that stuff. Like, I want to know more about that. Get me there. And get me there quickly. Otherwise, what are you doing? I don't understand what we're doing if you're not hustling to get me there. Anyway, I've said all of that. This recording is long enough at this point. Watch the film if it's your cup of tea. If there's some things that I've missed about this whole universe, especially if there's something I missed in the second episode or the second movie that would have helped this third one make sense, let me know. Leave me a message in the show notes. There's a link in the show notes that will take you to a message board or a recording and a place where you can record a message to me, and I'll listen to it and I'll respond to it in the next episode. You're welcome to just leave me a comment too on this episode while you rate it 4 stars or more. If it's a negative comment, you can keep it. I'll just ignore it. But just feel free to interact with me and we can talk about it. That's that on that. I appreciate your time. I hope that you've been listening to this while you were completing something or just relaxing. And I hope I was able to help you complete that task or relax a little bit before you do this other thing. I will say, like I always say, please be kind to yourself and take care of yourself. You're the only you got. And things happen. So just breathe through it. At the end of the day, that one thing that didn't go your way or that it didn't work out the way you needed it to, there's a lesson there and one day you'll know it. But in the meantime, don't dwell on it. Just breathe and put one foot in front of the other. I know that's easier said than done, but you got to start somewhere. So, all right. Take care of yourself. Stay COVID-19 free. Protect your mental health. Happy Pride Month. And yay, summer. Go to the beach and be safe. All right. Until next time. Take care.